From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
In a way, it's much more cool to then say, oh, this is outrageous. How can they build that monument of me? You know, that's much more cool than to be like the members of Queen or so, you know, who show up at the Golden Globes with Graham King and say, we're so happy.
German director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's new film, Never Look Away, was inspired by the remarkable life of artist Gerhard Richter. The director spent months cozying up to the painter, now 86, and for a while Richter seemed to be happy to cooperate. Then it all went kaput. Richter trashed the film, based just on the trailer. The filmmaker is taking it in stride. Richter may not like Never Look Away, but the Academy nominated it for Best Foreign Language Film. This is von Donnersmarck's second nomination. He won in the foreign language category in 2007 with his debut feature, The Lives of Others. In between that film and this, he stumbled hard with the critically reviled Johnny Depp Angelina Jolie flop, The Tourist. Von Donnersmarck talks about all of this, but first on the News Banter, the House Democrats have some questions about Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's dealings in Hollywood. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we are seeing movement in Washington. We all know that there's been a special counsel investigation of the Trump administration. There's been a lot of attention on the role of Russia in election interference. Hollywood has now got a piece of this action in the form of the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. And as you know, Matt, Steven Mnuchin had a film finance entity here. He at one point was partnered up with Ryan Kavanaugh at Relativity. He moved to Warner Brothers, a deal with Brett Ratner. And at that time, James Packer, an Australian billionaire. And they financed a bunch of movies. And at a certain point, he became Secretary of Treasury, and he sold his interest in this company, Rat Pack Dune. We reported that this was to Ukrainian-born billionaire Len Blavatnik. Len Blavatnik is on the special counsel's radar as a person who may have been a person who contributed money to Trump and the Trump inauguration and various Republicans in the past couple of years. Now, several people on the Hill want to know, did Steve Mnuchin have some sort of relationship with Len Blavatnik in this Hollywood company that they need to take a look at? Because to just get to the point of why they're interested, this Treasury Department just lifted sanctions on oligarchs who are partners of Len Blavatnik's, and they want to know whether Steve Mnuchin was influenced by this relationship with this film financier, Len Blavatnik.
Right. And Len Blavatnik is not an insignificant figure. He is the owner of Warner Music Group. He's a very powerful investor, billionaire. Blavatnik bought into this film finance entity called Rat Pack Entertainment that has a relationship with Rat Pack Dune, which was the Steve Mnuchin vehicle. I know it's all very confusing, but basically, in a nutshell, the lawmakers are interested to know if Mnuchin's sale of his entity went to benefit Blavatnik in any way, and whether that could have influenced the Treasury Department's lifting of sanctions in a way that would benefit Blavatnik.
Yeah, I think they're interested in the whole relationship with Blavatnik, which goes back several years. Blavatnik is one of those guys who goes to Cannes with his big yacht and hangs out with movie people and had wanted to get into the movie business for a while and invested here and there and then got this deal with Warner Brothers. And the fact that the Treasury Secretary had a relationship with this, Blavatnik does not like to be called an oligarch, but with this billionaire who made his money in the post-Soviet era in Russia and who has these connections to these actual oligarchs who are close to Putin, all of that has created a look. You know, it's not that common for these people to be sending letters to the Secretary of Treasury saying, tell us about your Hollywood dealings. But that is what has happened here in a nutshell.
And Blavatnik is a U.S. citizen. We should say that. So he has always argued, I am a U.S. citizen. I am a businessman. I have many different dealings all over the world. And they are pushing back pretty hard. Mnuchin is saying he did not sell his interest to Blavatnik or any Blavatnik-related company, and that this was simply a social, friendly relationship they had, not a financial one. So we'll see what the federal government does.
Yeah, I would just note that Mnuchin has not said to whom he sold this company. If it wasn't Blavatnik, he might want to cast a little light on that. Like, he's just said, it's not him, but that's where it stops. I mean, disclosure would be, I sold it to this person instead.
And, you know, they have subpoena power. So they could subpoena him
the
and
house
ask
could,
him.
In fact, yes.
And yeah, if he doesn't, who did you sell this to?
Yeah, and they've asked him to provide all kinds of documents. And if he doesn't, they may very well subpoena him. The other thing I will note about Blavatnik is he may be an American citizen, but he was born in Ukraine and grew up largely in Russia and came here in his early 20s and has extensive ties, including business ties, as I said, to these significant oligarchs who are very much on the radar of Special Counsel Mueller. So Hollywood is getting its piece of that drama. Let me pivot to other drama, the drama at the Sundance Film Festival. We've seen some big ticket purchases, and Amazon really stands out. They spent $13 million for this movie, Late Night, which is Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson. Mindy Kaling wrote it for Emma Thompson, and much to her pleasant surprise, Emma Thompson agreed to do the film. It's obviously about a late night show where a host has to bring in a diversity hire and is not happy about it. They paid $14 million for The Report, which is Adam Driver starring in a movie about the Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein's torture inquiry. And $14 million, this one raised my eyebrows, for Brittany Runs a Marathon, which it looks like a pretty small kind of independent film, but I guess Jen Salke, who now runs Amazon Studios, really fell in love with it.
Yeah, that's a pretty small niche play, in my opinion. And I've heard some snickering around town about this. You know, this is Jen Salke's first big Sundance, where she's up there looking at movies. And, you know, these are all record prices. All three of these films have set records for prices paid on the ground at Sundance. And a lot of people are wondering if Amazon overpaid or if they have Netflix envy with Netflix in the Oscar race this year and they're trying to get back in. The biggest successes that Amazon has had on the film side have been acquisitions. They bought The Big Sick at Sundance. That did very well in, on the box office and got some Oscar nominations. They bought Manchester by the Sea at Sundance, and that got some Oscar nominations. So I think they are probably seeing these movies and saying, hey, this works for us. Let's do it. But these prices are just so high.
Yeah, and I should mention Jen Salke comes from television. You know, she was at NBC and before that Fox. And so this is the first thing in movies for her. And as you know, as I know from having been at Sundance or other film festivals, there is a little bit of fest hysteria that oftentimes around these movies, because you're in a room full of movie lovers who sometimes, you know, they have a stake in supporting the movie. Sometimes they just love movies. But there, oftentimes there's like a more after effect when you look back and think, was that movie really that great?
Well, and we've seen examples of movies in the past year or two that were big Sundance hits and have just absolutely flopped at the box office. Movies like Patty Cakes, which was the toast of the festival 2 years ago. It was this young female rapper movie that did nothing at the box office. And you saw this past year, the Sundance Grand Jury winner, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, that movie barely got a release and did zero at the box office. And that was the toast of Sundance last year. So it's not an automatic thing that you pick up a movie for a big price at Sundance and automatically gets you in the Oscar race and box office. We'll see how these movies do.
Yeah, there was some other big sales. New Line was the biggest spender, buying Gurinder Chadha's Blinded by the Light, which is about a kid in the 80s who is inspired by Springsteen, and it does have that amazing music. That worked real well for Bohemian Rhapsody, great music. So we'll see about that one. And I think the biggest critical breakout from a distance is Lulu Wang's The Farewell, which I know our producer, Caitlin Parker, loved. Awkwafina, who broke out in Crazy Rich Asians, is starring in that, and she goes back to China and deals with family issues. It's a dramedy. That one went for $6 million, a modest $6 million to A24, and A24 has a pretty strong batting average when it comes to this type of movie, so it is definitely not their first Sundance. We'll see how they all do. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The German movie Never Look Away, in contention for Best Foreign Language Picture this year, tells the story of Kurt, a painter played by Tom Schilling. A defining experience comes early in the film when, as a young child in Germany during World War II, Kurt watches in horror as his schizophrenic aunt is hauled off by the Nazis. He never sees her again. With a runtime of more than 3 hours, the film follows Kurt's escape from communist East Germany with his young wife and his subsequent artistic triumph. But a dark shadow hangs over him because of his traumatic past. The director of Never Look Away is Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. This is his second Oscar nomination in the Best Foreign Language category. He won in 2007 for his debut movie, The Lives of Others. That film followed a Stasi agent in East Berlin who faces a moral crossroads as he's assigned to spy on a playwright. After that breakout success, Hollywood came for von Donner's mark. His next movie was Sony's The Tourist, starring Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp. That project ended up with a Rotten Tomato rating of just 20%. And though the film was nominated for some Golden Globes in 2011, that just made it material for host Ricky Gervais.
It was a big year for 3D movies. Toy Story, Despicable Me, Tron. Seems like everything this year was three-dimensional. Except the characters in The Tourist. I feel bad about that joke. I'll tell you why. I'm jumping on the bandwagon, because I haven't even seen The Tourist. Who has?
You look back on that movie, that was the siren call of the American studio?
Well, siren call, you know, I mean, I was just in the mood to do something light.
The Lives of Others was not light.
No, it wasn't light. You know, it was... I'd had a few pretty dark things happening in my life, among them being the death of my lead actor from The Lives of Others. That really made that whole chapter of releasing that film very depressing for me, because it was, in a way, we were having all these successes with the film, and I knew that this man was dying, and he didn't want anybody to know. So my wife and I, and he and his wife, were the only people to know about his impending death. And so they timed his chemotherapy so he could actually come to the Academy Awards and just have that brief moment there. And then he died. It was all, you know, really depressing. Then a year later, my father died, and it was just, you know, it was a really dark time. And I felt, you know, I want to do something light. And then Angelina Jolie approached me about this beautiful film that was going to be set in Venice. And I thought, yeah, you know what? That's going to be a light experience.
Right.
Well, you know, and then Johnny Depp came on board, and they were all wonderful, cheerful people in a beautiful setting. And I thought, you know, we'll make something really light, and it'll be like, you know, a Christmas present to the audience. You know, then I think that one thing that I'd underestimated is that the expectation with which people go into a film is immensely important. So, you know, people thought, okay, this After the Lives of Others is going to be another really serious drama. And then the studio decided to market it as a tough action thriller, which it really wasn't at all. I mean, there was no action in the movie. So in a way, the critics were going to this saying, okay, well, it's not a drama, it's a thriller. Okay, so it better be a really thrilling action thriller. And then it turned out to be this light travel romance. And the image that I had in my head was, you know, I'd baked a beautiful dessert, kind of very light souffle or something. And people came in expecting, you know, a main course. And suddenly they're served a delicious dessert. And they say, well, this is a terrible main course. Well, yeah, it kind of is, but that's never what it was intended to be.
It was an expensive dessert as part of the thing. And that attaches to what the perception of the movie is.
But yes, although, you know, I mean, this is another thing that showed me that even in our business, there is a lot of fake news. One thing that was continuously reported everywhere was that it was a big flop, but you know, it did very well business-wise.
$278 million
Yeah,
worldwide.
So you know, and it
but,
reached.
You know,
people.
I mean, math-wise, it's $100 million budget, I think, right?
Yeah.
So you know, you market it. 270 divided by roughly two. You know, I would say.
You know, I think the studio was happy. You know, we were happy. You know, I got more letters for that movie than I ever did for any of my other films from people saying this was a film that gave them, you know, happiness and joy at a moment when they needed it. That was kind of what I was, I was aiming for. So for me, it was, I learned some things in making it, but I think most of all, I learned that expectations have to be managed about what, you know, of what a film is going to be. I think it's always a mistake to present a film as something other than it is. You know?
Well, I'll pause on this for another minute or two, because mm-hmm. Lives of Others is like a $2 million budget.
Yeah, possibly around that. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you're just like this big number on the next movie.
You are focusing on the business.
I do. That's why this show is called.
Okay, good.
The name of it is okay. Giveaway. But you know, I do want to, I mean, we mm-hmm. will not only talk about numbers, but
yeah.
I'm just actually wondering about the experience of going from this is my small budget and I therefore must do it this way to I really have a big budget here. What is that like as a director?
Well, I think the things that matter in filmmaking don't really change all that much. It's really, if you're there in a room working with the actors, then all the whole machine, you know, whether you have 50 trucks waiting out there or two, that doesn't make much of a difference in that decisive moment. I'd say the rest is just trappings. Also, you know, a lot of that money you don't really necessarily see on screen. It's what's paid to the big stars. And, you know, it's the big paycheck for these illustrious department heads who've won multiple Academy Awards. You know, it's just that doesn't really make that much of a difference. Often it has to do with just the speed with which something will happen. You say, oh, you know what? I'd kind of like the angle in that room to be changed slightly. And an hour later, it's all done. In a way, it makes some things a little speedier, but the essential things don't change. You know, I really think that if I were given a choice, which is, you know, keep all the big trappings of a movie and, you know, all the incredible lights and sets and builds and costumes, but you have to make the film with, let's say, your second choice actors, or make it with your first choice actors and shoot it on an iPhone with available light, you know, I'd always choose option two, because what the filmmaking is about is the acting and what they transport. And that's always the same, whether it's a student film or a $100 million production.
And there's been quite a pause between The Tourist and this film. I don't know, this film you worked on for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how many years in progress was this film.
So this was about 4 years. I mean, if I include all the research that I did for it and writing the screenplay and, you know, raising the money and the pauses in between where the production came to full stop, because in the US you have a studio which will then pay for the whole thing, ideally, but that's not how it works in Europe. You have to piece it together with lots of different financiers, and from time to time things just ran into real problems. But that was a four-year process, so that accounts
so
for four of the 8 years.
I mean, I wonder whether, again, with a business question, but the equation, I mean, you had this Oscar-winning movie that, and then you had this movie that was what it was. Do you feel like it...
I get the feeling you didn't love it.
No, I actually... just telling me the truth, I never saw it.
Okay, okay.
So, sorry.
All right, I'll send you a DVD.
Thank you. I just get drowned in... Sometimes I don't see certain things, but did it hinder you, do you think, when you're trying to set up this movie? Or does it? Does the lives of others carry so much weight in Europe, in particular, that they say, "Well, that other thing was just you doing a Hollywood movie, but now you're back where you belong."
Welcome. I think I think people value experience. I think people who have seen the film know that, you know, despite the outrage over the from the critics of being served a dessert rather than a main course, they know it's a, you know, it's a good film that works, that's fun to watch, that, you know, got good exit polls and, you know, all that. So I think that I always have a lot of offers. I think anybody whose films have done okay and gotten the right awards have, you know, gets a lot of offers, because there's not so many directors maybe that people are happy to trust with the big sums of money that it does cost to make a film. No, it was more that it was, I'd written a screenplay right after I made The Tourist, which was, I think that was perceived as too dark in a way for the system. So that threw me back a little bit time-wise. Then I was working on a big project with my dear friend Sam Raimi. We were going to set up like a label within a studio where we would... We'd gotten together a group of directors who were interested in working in that segment of films, exactly kind of that budget range that has kind of disappeared.
The mid-range.
The mid-range. And we had, you know, then CAA set us up with the perfect Chinese partner. And and then suddenly, you know, they had all, we had actually had so many people interested, but they said, you know, this was the person we should do it with. Then suddenly the regulations changed in China because it can just be dictated from above. And, you know, that also cost a lot of time, you know, all those things. So, and then at some point I just said, okay, there's this subject that I'm really interested in. I'm just going to do that in Germany, where I will not be, you know, of course, a lot of things are very, very complicated in the European film business, but at least, you know, it's something where, you know, I know so perfectly how to navigate it that I knew I'd be able to make exactly the film that I wanted to make.
Coming up after a short break, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck explains how he became like a therapist to famous German artist Gerhard Richter, who turned out to be a prickly patient. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck about his Oscar-nominated movie, Never Look Away. The film is now playing in New York and opens in Los Angeles on February 8th. Never Look Away begins in Hitler's Germany, when a young boy named Kurt is taken to an exhibition of what the Nazis called degenerate art. As the Nazi guide disparages the paintings, Kurt's aunt tells him not to look away from the work, and that everything true is beautiful.
nie wegsehen Kurt. Alles, was war, ist schön.
Not long after, Kurt's relationship with his beloved aunt ends brutally. He watches the Nazis haul her away and years later learns she was sent to an institution for the mentally ill, which in Nazi Germany was a death sentence. Never Look Away follows Kurt as he grows up in East Germany, goes to art school, marries, and eventually escapes to the West, where he can pursue his vision instead of being forced to produce socialist propaganda art. Of course, he's a happier man, but he still must reckon with a dreadful secret regarding his father-in-law that harkens back to Kurt's childhood trauma. Never Look Away was inspired by the life of German artist Gerhard Richter, now a somewhat testy 86 years old. But it is not a biopic.
I believe in fiction. Of course, fiction, to be good, has to be inspired by life. So here, I was inspired by an element from Gerhard Richter's life. I knew that he'd painted a beautiful painting of his aunt, a young, attractive woman, holding him as a little child, and that he later revealed that his aunt had been murdered by the Nazis because she was schizophrenic. And then I read a great piece by an important German journalist where he started researching Richter's background and found out the yes. father of the woman that Gerhard Richter ended up marrying was a high-ranking SS doctor and had been very high placed within this so-called eugenics program that the Nazis had to murder people that they deemed genetically, you know, unfit to reproduce. And you have a situation where, you know, a young man, an artist trying to find his voice as an artist, is living under the same roof as this man. And his greatest trauma, the very thing that is propelling him to become an artist, was caused by the man who was the father of the woman that he loves. You know, it just seemed such an interesting starting point right. that I thought this can be a very good basis for, you know, telling a tale of liberation, of, in a way, freeing yourselves of everything that you were perhaps raised to be that might be wrong, you know.
So to study your inspiration, you court Gerhard Richter,
yes,
who is now in his 80s, and you send him a letter, and I'm trying to sort of fast forward, but you become very engaged with each other. He's telling you things about his life.
Yeah.
You're writing things and, I think, reading to him.
So, you know, since the story was inspired by his life, among other elements, I thought it would be interesting to, you know, throw my story at him and gauge from his reaction whether there was something where I was far off just in terms of tonality and all that. So I thought it would be useful to meet him also. But I thought, you know, he's a very busy man and, you know, a painting that he does in half a day will sell for $20 million. So his time truly is money in a way that I think no one else's time is. So I thought I'd maybe get an hour. But I ended up staying for many weeks. And then in the end, we even took a trip together to Dresden. I mean, he lives in Cologne now.
Part of the film is set in Dresden.
Yes. Yeah. He opened up to me. He let me record all those conversations and just shared his life to me, I think, because he was interested in exploring his own life and really thinking it through. And he knew that, in a way, there was an element of fictionalization here that would allow him a little bit of distance from the final product.
Well, it seems, sitting from the great distance of me having seen the film and done a bit of reading, that he has some kind of a issue of wanting to be known but not known.
Yes, I think, I mean, any analyst, for example, will tell you that there's a certain type of patient who really wants analysis and they want to explore their lives, but they'll get really, really annoyed at the analyst from time to time. And I think this is a pattern that Gerhard Richter shows also. So, I mean, but I can understand that, you know, in a way, I was quite surprised how much he opened up and our agreement was I'd never reveal what was true.
Right, it's very ambiguous what's invented and what isn't.
Exactly. So, I mean, so when I was done with the script, I read him the whole script. So nothing would surprise him. I mean, he then actually did ask me to change two little things, which I changed simply because it didn't matter that much. And, you know, I didn't want to hurt him. But then when I was done with the movie, I called him again and I said, I'd like you to be the first one to see the movie. And he said, you know what, I just don't feel up to seeing it. And I was a little disappointed because I'd put a lot of things in there that only he would be able to appreciate. So I tried to convince him to see it. Then he said, well, I mean, you know, maybe I'll watch it on DVD. I said, no, that I can't do.
You know, it has to be on a big screen. Look at your pictures on a slide, dude? Yeah, I'm not doing it.
Exactly. So I said, I'll rent you a theater. You know, you can watch it there all on your own or with whoever you want to be there. I don't have to be there. But he didn't feel up to it. And then I thought, you know, I kind of understand that, because if someone had taken my life, for instance, and made a film about it, and let's say if there were heavy trauma in it, like in the case of Gerhard Richter's life, then either I'd find that it was too close to reality and that would be painful, or it was too far away from reality and that would be painful also. So in a way, I really think this is a film for everybody except Gerhard Richter. And then I left him in peace with that.
He did turn around having heard the script. I assume he didn't say, don't make it. You said he asked for a couple small changes. Yeah. He did it. Now he's accusing you. He says you've done everything in your power to link his name to your movie. And he called it a concoction, I think. Were you just like, what? Or were you like, well, that's artists?
I mean, it's a little bit. So I'd talked to a couple of his biographers beforehand, and they'd warned me that this was going to happen.
You know? I see.
I thought, you know, since I got more time with him, and in a way, he was even more open with me than he was with many of his biographers, I thought that maybe I'd escape that, but I didn't.
You read the signals wrong.
So I wasn't surprised, but I think it's too bad that he didn't see the film. But yeah, I understand it. And I mean, I have a world of respect for him.
Do you feel that his negative reaction hurt the film? It didn't perform in Germany quite as hoped. Do you think he hurt it?
Well, he's older, richer, and more German than I am. So, you know, there's a little bit of a feeling like he's the master. And therefore, there's a little bit of that spirit of a belief in authority that is, you know, wonderfully absent in the United States. And it's one of the things that I love so much about this country and one of the reasons that I live here. There is more of a, I do find a lot more groupthink in Germany than I've encountered in America.
So maybe he did hurt the film?
You know what? I mean, it's still out in Germany. And now, actually, you know, the thing is,
now it's nominated.
Now it's nominated, and that's going to lead to a lot of admissions in Germany. That's how it works. I mean, on The Lives of Others, they had it very difficult at the beginning in Germany. And then we got, you know, those nominations and then even won the Academy Award. And that made a real difference because suddenly a great film authority has sanctioned the film. You know, there's a little bit of that. So I think it'll now play more strongly, hopefully mirroring what happened with The Lives of Others. And it's been so warmly embraced so far by at all the screenings that we've had here in the United States, so I'm hopeful.
You're not waiting by the mailbox for a note from Richter.
You know what? I wrote him, actually, just a few days ago, I wrote him a letter saying, look, you know, what could I have done differently along the road, you know, than just keep you informed at every single step? You know, I'm really asking that. Is there anything that you would want me to do differently, and how can I heal this rift between us? But he hasn't replied to that.
One gets the idea that he might enjoy a little bit the...
Yes, I mean, some people thrive on kind of conflict. And also, you know, there's one factor, which is that, so you have this film out, which in a way can be seen as a great monument that was built to your strength of character. And in a way, it's much more cool to then say, oh, this is outrageous. How can they build that monument of me? You know, that's much more cool than to be like the members
Look,
of Queen
me.
Or so,
yes.
You know, who show up at the Golden Globes with Graham King and say, we're so happy and pose for pictures with Rami Malek. You know, it's not exactly cool, right? I mean, it's wonderful. It's lovely. And, you know, I'm very happy that the wonderful members of Queen are doing that. But it would be much more cool for them to say, hey, piss off, guys. You know, how can you do this? You know, the reality was so much cooler.
Some people think that's what should have happened.
Yeah.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck is the director of Never Look Away. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Kim. I enjoyed our conversation a lot.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.